Haven't even said that.
Gosh, I wasted that.
Today is February 21st, 2009. This is Life, the Universe, and Everything. The panel is How to Fill 100,000 Words and Not Be Boring. Something that Kindle very much needs.
Oh, you...
This panel is entitled, How Novelists Fill 100,000 Words and Still Keep the Story Interesting. And we have an all-star panel up here. Excited to hear from you. Okay. I'm going to be moderating for us, as usual, because I decided to do it. We'll go ahead and start with the standard introductions. We'll start with Tracy.
Tracy Hickman.
I'm going to have to sit somewhere else.
Times, New York Times. These kids are going to be too bad. 57 books currently in print and in print in most languages worldwide.
I'm Dave Wolverton, David Barlow. I only have 6 New York Times bestsellers, 50 books in print, and include how many languages I've heard. Something close to 25-30.
Brandon Sanderson, 1 New York Times bestseller, and 6 books in print. Wow, this is loud. Hey, Tracy, what's the weirdest language you're published in? The weirdest in your opinion, besides English.
Weirdest?
Yeah, the most obscure that you would say.
Latvian.
Okay.
Yeah. Latvian. Although the Hebrew translations are always fun to look at.
I guess I fall somewhere in between all of that. My 52nd book will be out next month. I'm not in quite as many languages as they are. But I think my most obscure language is Bulgarian. And I've only been on the New York Times bestseller list once, but I have been on the USA Today bestseller list 4 times. Go figure.
It's a better list.
I'm Paul Jeunesse. My book is published in English. Haven't made those lists yet. I'm hoping to someday. I have two novels that are, one's out and the other one's coming out soon. Sold 10 short stories. I'm the editor of the Writers Symposium e-zine. You can sign up for free. Grab a card. And I am in awe of these gentlemen.
So, the topic of our panel is how to fill 100,000 words. I'm not sure how to fill 100,000 words because I've never done it. I've never kept it that short. Well, I'm joking. My kids' books have, but I'm currently working on a 750,000 word book. So, that'll be the Wheel of Time book. So, yeah. It's at 450 and climbing right now. And I've told them 750 is where we're going. So,
that's until Harriet gets home.
Until Harry gets a hold of it. Well, she keeps cutting stuff out and then wanting me to add more. And so I think it may end up at the same length after she's done with it. But anyway. Yeah. How do you fill 100,000 words? This is actually a good question. I'm going to change it to how do you fill 100,000 words. Well, it says how do you fill 100,000 words and keep it interesting. Filling 100,000 words is not too hard. You can hit, copy one word and then write a macro to copy it 100,000 times and you've written 100,000 words. How do you write 100,000 good words? That's the question. And I would say, let's get initial thoughts from the panelists and then I'll start addressing questions at you for more specifics, if that's all right with the panelists. And we'll start with Tracy again. We'll go the other way next time so you don't have to start that time.
Man, I wish it was only 100,000 words. Just for everybody's information, word count is where it's at, and that's how things are measured by. Most fantasy novels come in around 120 to 140,000 words, maybe up to 160,000 words, but it's a good length at about 120 to 140,000 words. How do you do that and make them all good words? structure. Story is structure. It's all about the bones. It's all about how the foundations and how it's all put together in the foundations. If you can write 120,000 words, if you just keep writing words. But to make it interesting, to make it solid, and to carry the reader from one end of, from word one to word 148,762, under it all it's got to be structure. It's all in the bones.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much most of it. Part of my structure, the first thing that I look at typically is setting, and that's because my characters grow out of the setting. So I start looking for what's a fascinating setting, what is it that interests me, and how can I put that into a story, And I think about, for example, when I was a little kid, I became fascinated with sewers. Okay, we had a sewer out in front of our house, and I remember looking down there one day into the water through the grate and seeing this big fish swim by. Okay, we were really close to the Willamette River in Oregon, and some guy came by and said, "What are you doing there, kid?" I'm 5 years old. I said, "There's a big fish." He says, "What kind do you think it was?" And I have no idea. He says, "Maybe it was a salmon." And I said, "Oh, yeah, there's a salmon down there, Anyway, I became fascinated with sewers, and I remember thinking, God, could I live down there? And I thought, if I had a pontoon boat, I didn't know what it's called, I could live down there. And what kind of people do live down in the sewers? But, very often settings, become the catalyst for all sorts of stories. If you look on TV, you've got things like ER, some other ones, 30s Rock, house, doctor's offices, courts, all of these places have served as interesting places. Things like Phantom of the Opera, all of these settings serve as something that is just one little catalyst for making an interesting story. So that's where I start, because my characters are going to grow out of them to some degree. If I start wondering what kind of people live in sewers, I could imagine some fascinating medieval sewer cities, that would be great places to explore,
I would say fill 100,000 words, keep it compelling. I usually divide things in my mind in three sections. We've got plot, we've got character, we've got setting. Pretty standard. I'm going to approach this panel with the questions looking at those three areas, just so you know. We'll talk a little bit about each and maybe a little bit about editing. Plot, the way to fill 100,000 words and keep it interesting is to have interesting subplots that give a sense of progression. That would be my tip on the plot. I'll ask some more questions to the panelists about that. Character, it's got to be a compelling character. We'll talk a little bit about that. I don't know if we can cover all of this in one panel, but we'll try. Setting, for setting, if you want to fill a lot but keep it interesting, the setting can't be big dumps of information. The setting has to be interwoven. If you can do that, you are giving a rich and lavish setting without boring people. And what we're trying to do is have a big, nice, long, thick book that doesn't bore anyone. So I'll ask questions because I'm in charge relating to those three things, but we'll go on to Lee.
There are a number of ways to approach the same end. And in an earlier panel, Laura pointed out that Tracy is, I think it's fair to say, compulsive outliner who has to have everything detailed down to the last setting. Now, maybe it was misrepresenting what she said, but I got the impression that he's pretty organized, pretty detailed, down to a lot of details. And he's right. You got to have a good structure. But how you get there, as Kevin indicated, is another question. I tend to start very plainly with the takeoff on what Brandon was talking about, what David was talking about in terms of setting. But I take the setting a lot further than that. I basically look into the cultures, even the languages, the geography, things like the prevailing winds. I've got maps, I've got outlines on the political structure, the economic structure, the trade patterns, and what have you. In short, my structure starts with the society, not necessarily with the individual. But it's definitely a structure, but it's a little bit different way of looking at it. that sense. The other thing that you've got to remember is, as a writer, the only thing that really counts if you're going to get a book published is it's got to entertain. Everything else comes after that, because nobody's going to read it if you don't entertain them. And the key to entertaining, as far as I can tell, is having characters that you either can identify with or hate so much that you can't wait to see them crash. That's my thoughts on that point.
How do you feel 100,000 words? A writing teacher once taught me that in the beginning of the book, the main characters have a goal. And as the book goes along, they get further and further and further away from their goal. In the beginning of the book, looks like maybe, you know, it's going to be okay. And then as it goes on, it just gets more impossible that they will succeed. The tension just builds and builds and builds. You know, and that keeps you reading. And start thinking about some of the books that you've read. You know, and I was just thinking about Brandon Salantris, the main character in the beginning of the book. You know, he's, I don't want to spoil too much, but he's going to have a pretty good life. And then something kind of bad happens, we'll just say. And but the whole rest of the book, he's getting further and further and further away from his ultimate goal, and it's very satisfying.
All right. Oh, yeah.
Well, no, I just wanted to clear something up in terms of outline.
Go ahead.
I do an outline, but when I'm talking about the bones of the book, I'm not talking about the outline. As I mentioned yesterday in one panel, an outline, holding onto an outline, you should hang onto an outline the same way you hang onto a handful of marbles. If you try to hang on too tightly to the marbles, you try to hang on too tightly to the outline that you have, then you start forcing your characters, you start forcing their dialogue, you start forcing their actions, you start forcing their decisions, and all the marbles pop out from your iron grip and you lose all your marbles. If on the other hand, and there are people who do write this way, and I suppose if it works for them, that's fine, but if you simply say, well, here are my characters and here's the setting, and you just open up your hand from this outline and say, well, let's just see where the characters lead me in this story, you have no structure. And the characters start wandering off and doing their own thing and going places where you never really needed them to go. And the story loses structure and you lose all your marbles. An outline should be held the way you would hold a handful of marbles, which is you give it a form, a shape, a structure. And this is what I'm thinking about in terms of the bones. This is the underpinning structure. And then the marbles all fall naturally into this structure. Suddenly everything becomes organic. Their motivations spring from the setting and their experience, and their motivations move into the plot and move the plot forward naturally, organically. The plot's not so much... The outline isn't so much a rule as a guideline. Okay. But this is what I'm thinking about when I'm talking about the bones. You hang on to the outline with the underlying form of the outline, but then you let the characters fall naturally and organically into that. That means that the outline is going to change as you go along. But it also means that the basic structure underlying the story and the book remains intact.
So let's talk a little bit more about plot. Both Paul and Tracy mentioned it. Let's get into it. I personally, one of my feelings is that you want the reader to feel a sense of progression. They're working toward their goal, even if things are getting more dismal. There's a sense of motion. Something is changing. You are progressing. What are tricks that you use? We call them tricks. Tools. There you go. That sounds so much better. What are tools that you use to give a sense of progression to the reader as they're going through this plot? We'll start with Dave and work through, and then end with Tracy this time. Okay?
My wife has warned me not to give out all my secrets, so I think I should pass this. No, seriously. One thing that I do is that whenever I write a chapter, something has to change. Okay? My character might need to change his mind about something. He might need to decide to go off in a different direction. He might kill someone, and suddenly the entire book, you know, turns on its heels, you know. But something has to change in every single chapter, or I'm not going to write that chapter. Or if I do write that chapter, it goes into the garbage.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. It's very good. Two quick tools to use to keep in mind that I occasionally use. You don't ever use all the tools, but one of them is a time bomb, which will give a nice sense of progression even if your characters are staying in the same place. If the reader knows that at a certain point something terrible was going to happen or something, that you've got a deadline and the book moves toward that deadline, you will have a sense of urgency and progression naturally. Another way to do it is the travel log, which I don't personally enjoy as much, but it can be used very effectively. This is one of the reasons why fantasy books have maps. If characters are traveling from point A to point B, it is a natural sense of progression. And this can be expanded all sorts of directions. Larry Niven and Jerry Cornell, their favorite book of mine is Inferno, which if you've read, is this delightful book that's a sort of fantasy take on Dante's Inferno with a science fiction author getting sent to hell. And they have a nice little map in the front which outlines all of this, and you can watch the characters move through all the different sections of the Inferno of Hell as they approach the center, and you'd say, oh, what are they going to find there? And this sense of progression means that even though the book is essentially a series of vignettes, they go here and experience this, they go here and experience this, they go here and experience this, you feel that it's all connected in a sense of progression because they're moving. These are just two of the tricks. There are a lot of them, but I'm going to pass it on to Lee and see if he's got any other tools.
What if I said no? No, I guess I take a little couple of things. I take a little bit different take on what Dave said. I don't know that everything always has to change, but the reader has to learn something new with every chapter. Sometimes it's action, sometimes it's not. There should be a continuum, I guess what I would call it is an unveiling sense or a continuing sense of revelation. Something else has changed, something else is new, something else is added. Sometimes it's adding complication. But that gets a little tricky because there are some authors who add complication upon complication, but when you look at it, it's only complication for the sake of complication. And your complication should be of the realistic nature. That is to say, well, there's a simple old folk saying, it's hard to remember that your objective was to drain the swamp when you're ass deep in alligators. And it's often useful to have your main character ass deep in alligators trying to get to his objective and finding that there are an awful lot of alligators that he really never even wanted to deal with before you get to that. The other thing is make the bad guys really smart. One of the problems that an awful lot of what I guess I would call genre fantasy is that it still plays into the idea of a stupid, powerful villain. That doesn't work. Anybody who's powerful is not going to be stupid. Now, there are smart people who are not powerful, but there are damn few powerful people who are not at least cunning, if not smart. If you have really smart villains, it will keep your heroes on their toes and it will keep people really looking at what's going on. A lot of good stuff for these guys, that's for sure. One little trick tool I have for you is you set up a certain expectation. You know, the main character believes a certain thing. They believe that the world is this way. And as the book unfolds, they start to learn that now the world is not that way. And it's as if you're discovering things, you know, you're breaking expectations. Every time you get to a new place, it's like, no, they really aren't this way. They're not the evil Nazis that we thought they were. They're actually our friends.
And it's really hard, you know, you think of them as the Nazis, and all of a sudden, no, they're your friends. So I like to do that. That's one of my little tricks. And I think they've already covered the rest of it. You know, maybe Tracy's got something good. What do you got?
One of the things I was going to say is that when I talk about change, there are different types of changes. One is an intellectual change, where you learn something. One is an emotional change, where you change the way that you feel about something. Like, Donna always hated guys who wore Levi's until she saw John, okay? Then there's the physical change, where, you know, a person takes a bullet, you know, something like that. So there are different types of changes. So when I say the passive change, I don't mean that it's... I like to mix it up and say, okay, I'm going to have an intellectual change here, emotional change on the next chapter, and a plot change, you know, where we've got characters dropping out of the story on the next one. Good like that.
Okay, I'm going to launch into this. First of all, when you're talking about the time bomb, okay, there are actually two kinds of plots that you can set in a story. One is what's called a time lock, which is your time bomb, where you have a certain length of time before it all goes off. By the way, in terms of evil characters, someone once called me the vice president of evil. Meaning that I came up with really great villains. My answer to that was, who's president and what do I have to do? There's the time lock, which is the time bomb ticking down and coming down to the, you know, this is why every thermonuclear device has a digital clock on it. Okay? When I am the evil overlord, I am taking the digital clock off any nuclear device, okay? Or it will go off at 7 minutes 32 seconds, okay? Just to really mess up the bad guy. Or the good guys. But see, this is an important point. To me, they are the bad guys. And this is what we're talking about, intelligent evil. Which is to say that whoever is your villain in your story, whoever the bad guy is in your story, really needs to be convinced that he is the good guy. That what he is doing is absolutely justifiable in every sense of the word, and that he is the one saving the world from whatever. Even if it's just from guys in white hats. He has to be convinced that he is the good guy. Okay? The slightly whiplash kind of bad guy just doesn't work. You need to have a guy absolutely convinced of his cause. The film Air Force One, for example, Gary Oldman plays the Russian radical who's taken over Air Force One and is shooting people on Air Force One. He is obviously the bad guy. But he is convinced to his soul that what he is doing is absolutely right. So much so that he's a much more interesting character than the president is in this story. And he's more understandable and almost more sympathetic than the president is in that particular film. That being said, we have time lock, which is the clock on the bomb, and before I move away from evil too far here, there is a website that deals specifically with lists of things that evil overlords should avoid. Please go look it up. It's a wonderful website, awful lot of fun to read, and you should avoid all those things, right? Including designing the costumes for all of your henchmen. You just shouldn't do that. So we have time lock, which is the time bomb that's going off, and it's clicking down in time, and you have a deadline in time. There's another clock that you can put in your book that is called an option lock, which is that the options of the characters are getting narrower and narrower. That their choices are getting fewer and fewer, and they are being trapped and constrained in the options that they have. This feeling also brings motion to a book. Political books use option lock very often to keep things moving forward as the character finds himself trapped in the options that are available to me. All of that being said, I'm a big believer in Joseph Campbell and the structure of the monument. And I believe that the monument structure that's outlined in Joseph Campbell's book, The Girl with a Thousand Faces, is a structure that is hard-coded into all of humanity. It's how we view the world. It's how we make sense of the world. As human beings, when we see things happening around us and the chaos of input that we have coming into us, we take all of this chaos, and the only way we make sense of it is to make it into story form, naturally. And Joseph Campbell talks about this story form. This is being used against us, currently, in a number of different ways, and there's an entire other soapbox thing on that. But the point here in terms of storytelling and the structure of your book is that the Campbell monolith has a natural progression to it and has motion built into it. And so as a basic structure, the Campbell monolith and the mythic cycle is an excellent framework on which to gauge the motion of your book forward over a lengthy period of time.
Let me do some summarizing here of what the panel just said, and maybe try and point it toward the topic, which is, again, filling 100,000 words. We've talked a lot about making your villain smart. If you're trying to fill space, remember, if your villain is intelligent, your villain can make and should make things worse for the heroes. If your villain is smart, they can anticipate what the heroes are doing. They will figure it out, they will change things, and it will drive your story. Some people often talk about the fact that, in many ways, villains are the ones who drive a story, because a lot of the best protagonists would be sitting at home, would love to be sitting at home doing nothing. They have to be out there saving the world because the villains are ruining it. And this means, you know, that's a different topic entirely if we want to talk about proactive protagonists, which you need to have. But all I'm saying is if you have a competent villain, you can use the villain's intelligence to give you plot twists to continue your story. Something that that Lee mentioned was Revelations. Go watch the movie or the TV show Lost if you want to see how doling out information can drive a plot and keep you going. Knowing which pieces of information to give when can keep your reader reading and can keep you going in your plot. So, again, that's something that Paul talked about is promises and fulfilling the promises, but fulfilling them in ways the reader doesn't expect. Again, this gives you more room to expand. If you give a promise to the reader, you need to fulfill it, but you never want to fulfill it exactly as they expect. You twist things a little bit, that launches you into a new set of promises, which you can fulfill in different ways. And the last thing I would mention is, everyone's talked about this, but just to boil it down, escalation is how you keep your plot moving across this entire space. Everything escalates step by step. It gets worse and worse, or bigger and bigger. Let's move on then to character. Specifically, how can you use character? What tools can you use with character? Assume that our audience is writing a book and it's just coming out too short. They don't feel like it's got enough meat to it, enough length to it. They're coming in at 42,000 words and they need at least 80, hopefully more like 100. They're writing fantasy. How can they use character more effectively? And I'm going to start with Lee. How can they use character more effectively to fill those pages in a good way?
Got to get the right mic here. I guess the way I do it, and I don't know if it's different anyway, but I'll give an example. In one of my latest Reckless books, I'm Character in Natural Order Mage, is about as stubborn as you could possibly get. And he's perfectly well convinced that everybody ought to see the world the way he sees the world. Consequently, almost every interaction with anybody who's different is somewhere between difficult and a disaster. That's one way of using character. Generally speaking, most people who are heroes or villains don't get along exactly
perfectly with everybody else. They have flaws. Those flaws generally lead, talking about progression, to either confrontations or avoidances. It doesn't matter which, because they'll both move you, which change everything. If you're in a political book and you can't read people, you're in big trouble. If you happen to be a natural order mage and you don't know what you're doing, but you somehow can do it, that's going to create certain problems along the way. If you are so smooth and so well endowed in dealing with people, there's going to be a certain subset of people who will distrust you on principle. Those are some examples. Characters, you know, why I read. I love characters. I love exploring characters. You know, I have a lot of plot going on in my book, so usually there's so much to do. There's so far to go that I don't usually end up short on time. But what I would say is add more conflict to your character. And, you know, I don't just mean, you know, throw in so they're running into some wolves or something, okay? You know, make it meaningful. Make it add to the story in a significant way. Add more conflict. And then whenever you add conflicts, the characters need to make decisions, yes. And their decisions need to have consequences. And we tend to want to be nice to our character. No, I couldn't, well, we don't, because we're evil, I'm pretty sure. I think Lee's president, by the way, Tracy.
Well, now I know what to do.
Yeah. So remember, you are evil when you are a writer, okay? You must torture your characters. Continually torture them and do bad, bad things, and that will make the story more interesting in general. And when you find yourself being nice to your character at the end of the scene and giving them an out, don't do it. Do something worse, complicate it, and that's going to make the plot, you know, even worse. You know, it's going to escalate it even more. I wanted just to add one quick note to this personally. When I was first writing, my son, who is now older than most of the people on this panel except for Tracy, and maybe Dave, made the observation, "Dad, you got to torture your characters more."
Yeah, my wife says we must kill all our darlings.
Kill your favorite children.
Our darlings must die. And this is difficult. And it's not just a question of literally bumping them off in the text, although by all means that's the easy way. But yeah, fate worse than death. Take someone who is a paragon of honor and then suddenly show them to be anything but, to publicly humiliate them, to take a look at the character's weaknesses, and all characters must be flawed. Paragons are expectations that may be present within the book, but cannot be personified in a character. The book series that my wife and I are working on currently is called Dracus, and it's essentially Spartacus, a fantasy Spartacus kind of story. And we have our main character is Dracus. He's a former slave, and the slaves in this world are all kept in thrall by having their memories altered every night so that they forget anything bad that happened to them. So they're all very contented. And suddenly, in the catalyst here in the book, this spell is broken in this household, and every slave remembers every bad thing that happened to them. And it was a mess. And a terrible crime scene. CSI is going to have such trouble with this crime scene. But the point here is that the main character in this book is a guy named Dracus. He's a human named Dracus. Very few humans exist anymore. Most of them were nearly wiped out in the last war. And all humans that do exist are supposedly slaves. And there's this great overhanging prophecy that says that a guy named Dracus is going to return and lead humanity back in force and bring down the evil empire. And everyone is convinced it's this guy, except him. He doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to be it. He'd like to just find a quiet place and hide. He is not the paragon everyone wants him to be. And he is running as fast as he can from a destiny that is faster than he is. And it makes for an interesting character. You have to have characters who are flawed, who are afraid, who have a terrible weakness, an addiction, a fault, and it's the only way you're going to make anybody interesting. And this isn't necessarily something that happens within the context of your book. This can happen off stage and already be established in your character. It's something you can revisit in the back. One of the great rules that I read once in terms of scenes is that you should always enter a scene late. You always should enter a scene after everything has started. You know, don't ever show everybody standing around for that split moment before they all start moving. Come in late into the scene. Having said that, a character, and David and I were talking at the beginning of the panel, said, you know, the subject of this panel, we're talking about a month's worth of material to talk about. But the question that recently was posed here, if you're coming up short, what do you do to your characters to pad your book? Don't. If your book isn't 100,000 words in length, I'm not going to go back to what I said before. It's not padding the character is not going to fix it. That's just chrome. You've got to go back and look at the structure of the book. You have to go back and look at the bones and see, why is my story not compelling enough here to cover 120,000 words? Now, there have been some times when I was in the middle of writing the Bronze Canticle series with my wife, there was a moment when we were writing the second book, and I said this to people yesterday, they should listen to their characters. There was a moment in that second book when the characters in my book were all standing around in a field shouting at me. It was a very weird moment. But it wasn't until later I realized they were shouting at me. I thought I was just writing dialogue. Okay. And what they were doing is they were all standing around, and the characters didn't know what to do next, where to go. They had no motivation for going anywhere or doing anything, so they're just all standing around, kind of tapping their swords in their hands and waiting. And I realized that they were shouting at me that I had screwed up the book. And I had to go back and look at the structure, and see, I had screwed up the basic structure in the book, the basic progression in the book, and I had led them into this dead end. And that meant throwing out three chapters, rewriting two other chapters, and all of a sudden it was all starting to work once again. And gratefully my characters could shout out. But, yeah, if you're having trouble fitting the length, the problem is in the structure of the book. It's not in giving a wooden leg to your character or, you know, having him drool on Thursdays. It's someplace else.
Yeah, I think Tracy is right. If you're coming up short, there's something missing from your story, most likely. And you... You know, it may just be blind to one certain thing. But for example, if I'm looking for what's wrong with my story, one thing I'll very often look at is things like, are my characters motivated? Have I discussed my motivations properly? Okay, I may have a dilemma. Did my character really think this through? Did I show it on paper? What led to his choice? What was his anticipated reward for taking this course of action versus the actual outcome? I may look at things like, is this character conflicted? Let's say that Tracy walks onto the stage and he says, "I'm Prince Charming," okay, and I've got my daughter over here that desperately wants to fall in love with him. Meanwhile, Dad over here is saying, "He's Satan." Okay, who is this guy really? There should be a question about the identity of this character. You know, each of us in our own minds think that we know who we are, but if you talk to other people, you might find out who they think we are. And very often, the story is where the character evolves into the person that he wants to be. You know, I mean, that's very often what the story is. So I deal with things like that, you know. Does my character have dilemmas thrown at him where he has to really sit down and, you know, say, "Gosh, I've got two women in love with me. Which one should I take? You know, which one's better?" Or, you know, maybe I've got two taskmasters that want me to do something. And, you know, who's going to give me the worst outcome? You know, I have to make those kinds of decisions. So it's almost always that there's little things missing.
And the characters can make that.
Yeah. What happens if, in fact, they don't want to evolve into the character, as Tracy suggested, that they want to be, or somebody else wants them to be?
One thing I would add here is, if you're chronically coming up short, there is one other thing that, if I'm allowed to disagree with Tracy just slightly, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to disagree with Tracy. You may want to consider multiple viewpoints. If you have a character who's compelling enough for 40,000 words and another character who's compelling enough for 40,000 words together, they can be a novel. This is one of the reasons why fantasy and historical both are some of these genres that get chronically long. It's because they both like multiple viewpoints. It's why the Wheel of Time book is going to be 750,000 words long. It's because I have 15 main viewpoint characters to deal with. This is something, though, that you have to be very careful with, because I think new writers often try too many viewpoints. I would say this panel, generally, 95% of you are not going to have the problem we're talking about. You're going to have the opposite problem. You're writing too long. You're going too long, and you need to learn how to edit, which was not the theme of this panel, but I do want to mention it. You should get in the habit, 95% of you, of trying to cut 15 to 20% of everything you write, and learning to be more concise, more concrete, and to stop repeating yourself.
And you're writing 750,000 words.
Yeah, it'll probably be a million and go down. So, but to do a little bit of a recap, I wanted to actually pointing out flaws and handicaps. Having the villain exploit the hero's flaws and handicaps can be an excellent way that your plot can evolve from who your characters are. And Tracy mentioned something that I wanted to reiterate. And this is actually something I learned from Dave's class when I took it. One way to use character to help give yourself conflict for your story is to sit down and say, okay, what is the role that this character is filling in the story? And then the next question being asking yourself, well, why can't they fit this role? Why are they the wrong person to be in this place in the story? If you put, you imagine the perfect character for this story, the perfect character everyone always puts in this story, say, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to do X. And who is that? And that can generate conflict. Really, if your story is too short, you don't have enough conflict, would be my rule of thumb that I'm saying, I would guess. I have met people that if their story is too short, it's because they aren't adding in any description. That's very rare for new writers. Most of the time, you're doing too much.
Or they don't have any dialogue, or they have no setting, or something. There's something really big missing.
I think we have time for one question, and then we'll go. And then we'll be good. I'm sorry I didn't leave a lot of time for questions, but let's go ahead and you and Firsto hit us.
Okay, so for all of you guys, what is your favorite book that you've impersonated? And then the second part of that is, who is your favorite author that like aspired to you or you just like?
Okay, the question is, for those in the back, what is your favorite book that you've written, and who is, which author inspires you the most? I suppose we can answer this just because we have very little time. It's not really on topic, but let's go ahead and then we'll close. So why don't we do, you can say that, and also we'll do closing words at the same time. So if you have any sort of anything you need to mention, like you're reading or signing or something like that, or any closing words, and we'll actually work this way this time with Paul first and then come backward this way. So, favorite book you've written, any favorite authors, and closing words.
Favorite book would be book 2 in the Iron Dragon series, which I recently finished, The Dragon Hunters. It's my favorite book right now. And book 3, which I'm working on, is probably going to be my favorite book. And I hope that the last book that I wrote is always my favorite book that I wrote. And my favorite writer, Tolkien's on the pedestal, Professor Tolkien. He's always going to be up there. Right now, my favorite writer is George R.R. Martin, The Song of Ice and Fire. I'm not going to do the favorite book that I've read because, at least in my view, naming a favorite book is like naming a favorite child, and I have 8 of them, and I'm not about to do that. I mean children, not books. And there are even more books. As far as the favorite author goes, I go outside the genre. My favorite author happens to be the Irish poet. Yates, William Butler Yeats.
Okay.
I don't have any other closing marks.
I can't pick a favorite either. I'm sorry. People ask me this all the time, and I never will. It's like Lee said, picking your favorite child. My favorite author is Ellie Paul Farland Hickman. I'm going to leave it at that.
Favorite book, it's, once again, it's really hard to say. Anytime you ask me, I'm going to give you a different answer. But, book on Betty White's and Magic, that was just a lot of fun for me. So I'm going to just say that one book for, because I probably never said that one before. The other thing is favorite author. Oh my gosh, there's so many great ones that, you know, I immediately go back to William Shakespeare, but I also love a lot of poets, and Borges is one of my favorites, and then within the genre, there are so many that I love different things about different authors. That's what it comes down to.
Well, first of all, one of the things that I wanted to mention is that my wife Laura and I have been invited to teach a workshop in science fiction and fantasy writing at the Writers and Illustrators for Young Readers Workshop, which is part of BYU Workshops here. It'll be this summer in June, I think. Yeah, Dave talked a couple of years ago, and Laura and I also talked a few years back, and they've asked us to come back. And that's and while it is a writing and illustrating for young readers workshop, the workshop that we do is for anybody. It's not a YA workshop, but it's for anybody, and it deals with just fantasy and science fiction writing. And you can find out about that online. Just, you know, Google it, it should come up. My favorite book, yes, it is like asking which is your favorite child, and perhaps your favorite child is the one that gives you the most trouble. So for me, I'll say The Immortals, because it says for me everything I think needs to be said about. Needs to be said about human condition. As for my favorite writer, yes, there are many wonderful, wonderful writers. I prefer usually to read biography and history as opposed to science fiction or fantasy. Generally speaking, when I try to read science fiction or fantasy, I find myself trying to fix it by page 4 because the author isn't taking it in the direction I really think it should go. I read a lot of history, I read a lot of biography, a lot of popular science types of books. But the one author I always come back to and always read is a little known writer here in the United States by the name of Stephen Leacock. He wrote in the turn of the century. He was a Canadian. He actually taught economics and wrote several books on economics at McGill University in Canada. but he was also a lecturer and wrote a lot of satire in his time. His nonsense novels are satires on literary forms that are a delight to read still. And in particular, my favorite works of his, there are two books, Sunshine Sketches of a Little Town, which is just a delightful pastoral novel set in rural Canada at the turn of the century, but the last century. And Arcadian Adventures Among the Idle Rich, which is set in a city in the same time period. Both of those are timeless. His language is fabulous. His ability to convey meaning in subtext is really inspiring. And all of these books, both of these books, are available online for free. They are, the text for these is in public domain. So his nonsense novel I recommend to you, and those two other books as well. I keep copies of his books with me to comfort me.